Good morning, Grid Connections listeners. And for those of you who may be listening for the first time, the Grid Connections podcast is the show where we unravel the complexities of electric transportation, renewable energy, and our electrical power grid that ties all of this together. I'm your host, Chase, and today we're joined by David Welch, a Bloomberg bureau chief based in Detroit. David shares his knowledge of the automotive market and perceptions of the market being based in the Motor City, especially around electric vehicles, a topic he's extensively covered and is passionate about. Our conversation with David takes us on a journey through the automotive industry's transformative shift towards electrification and autonomy. We delve into the heart of General Motors, guided by David's book, Charging Ahead, which is waiting for you in the show notes, should you want to learn more and get a copy yourself. Make sure to check it out. The book highlights CEO Mary Barra's leadership in steering the 120-year-old company into a new era. This episode unpacks the challenges GM faces from industry, along with even serious corporate change, to dealings with the UAW and how they're navigating the roadmap they've set out for electrification. But before we dive in, a little housekeeping. If you find today's discussion enlightening, please share this episode with someone who will appreciate the insights as much as you do. Your support helps us grow and continue bringing you the best content. Don't miss out on our weekly newsletter as well, packed with the latest industry news and behind-the-scenes content. Sign up today to stay connected with the Grid Connections community. You can also find a link to that in the show notes as well. Plus, we love hearing from you. If there's a topic or guest you're dying to hear from, reach out to us. Your feedback shapes our show. Now buckle up as we explore the electrifying road ahead with David Welch. Tune in to discover the innovations, challenges, and milestones defining the automotive industry's race towards a greener, more autonomous future. With that, enjoy. I'm joined today by David Welch. He's the bureau chief of Detroit for Bloomberg. Thanks for joining us today, David. I think we're going to be covering a lot of really interesting subjects. And I know you've recently come out with a book kind of talking about GM and some of the challenges. But real briefly, for anyone that might not be familiar with you, can you just share a little bit of your background and what you've been kind of doing in the space around automotive and how you got into it?
Yeah, so look, covering the auto beat on and off for more years than I care to recount, but 20-something years for Bloomberg, and before that, Business Week, which was acquired by Bloomberg. I was the Detroit bureau chief there, too. I actually started covering the auto beat in Texas, covering the plants down there, and this was late 90s, so we had like AutoNation and CarMax, the used car mega stores before they all morphed into something else. So I covered the retail side of it as well. And taking some breaks, gone to New York, covered Wall Street for a bit, and back in Detroit as bureau chief, covering the auto industry. And yeah, the book Charging Ahead, about Mary Barra's effort to try to transform GM into an electric vehicle maker. And it was tough sledding when I wrote the book a year ago, and it's even tougher now. And some of that was sort of presaged, and we can get into that whenever you want to talk about it. But that's what the book's about. It's not saying GM's the EV hero. It's sort of Mary Barra as this character trying to fix the company, change the company. And it's really tough to do that with an automaker that's 100 years old.
No doubt. I think that's a topic we've discussed quite a bit here. And I know a few episodes back, we had John McElroy on, and that was definitely a subject that we touched on, was the challenges that GM and others, kind of the big three, have definitely dealt with that disruption in the industry. I think let's start off, as someone who has been in journalism, specifically on the focus with automotive for so long, I think there's a lot of people who listen that who have been following and in the electric vehicle space especially have been kind of maybe disappointed is not the right word, but it has been interesting to see kind of gaps in coverage of electric vehicles, specifically around like the knowledge base of them. And recently we had kind of John Volker, and we've had, as I mentioned, also John McElroy on. And one of those topics we've really discussed is obviously the education at the dealership part. But I do think another part is around the actual journalism and coverage of the automotive space right now. What do you think are maybe some of the gaps that you've seen, at least around the knowledge base of electric vehicles? Or are there other areas that you think that kind of need to be improved to kind of help make it a lot easier for the average person to understand and get into the electric vehicle experience?
Yeah, look, I think in some ways there's this idea out there that EVs are really tough to own. And it is different. There are a lot of things EV owners need to learn, particularly with charging. And the charging network isn't great, but I think people dismiss the charging network as practically non-existent. The fact of the matter is, like, it does exist. It's just, it's not on every street corner like filling stations are. You live with EVs differently. And I've seen some really good stories done on that. It's just not the prevailing narrative for electric vehicles that you can live with them.
And for sure.
You can live with them pretty easily. It's just you're going to have to change habits to do that. And that's sort of a, you know, consumer journalism bit that I think could be told better. And the other part of it, I've pushed pretty hard internally at Bloomberg to make sure our coverage reflects this. EV sales aren't in retreat. Sales growth is declining. And that's an important distinction because, you know, before EVs came around, it was, well, the auto industry sells 110 million roughly vehicles a year globally. And, you know, that's why they're not very good stocks on Wall Street, because there's no growth there, right? It's not like AI or something that's new and there's going to be a bunch of revenue growth unless you steal it from somebody else. And that's still true. But with EVs, you know, EV sales are growing rapidly globally. And it has slowed down for a variety of reasons that we'll talk about. But it's not in retreat. It's not like suddenly nobody wants them. I think sometimes media coverage as a whole can get bipolar on something. You know, everything's great until we decide it's not, and then we hate it. There's some nuance here, and the nuance is it's still growing. It's just we're hitting this flat part of a classic technology S curve, I think. So, and you do see that reported. It's just sort of gotten, this narrative kind of took on a life of its own that nobody wants an electric vehicle anymore.
For sure. And I think you're totally right. I do unfortunately see why it's probably taken off more. Just it is kind of chasing clicks and the narrative sounds more interesting and gets people to kind of tune into it. But I agree with you. There's a challenge, I think, just with the automotive industry in general, with interest rates and many other things kind of going on right now that makes just new car sales in general harder. Are there any trends in particular that you think are the biggest headwinds or things that you don't think are getting enough coverage around that?
You know, it's something I've said this on Bloomberg TV a couple of times, actually several times, and that's not shameless self-promotion, but I think when people talk about EVs and whether or not consumers want them, and by consumers, we generally at this point in history mean people who aren't luxury buyers, who aren't early adopters for technology. Do they want them or not? You know, EVs get a lot of consideration. I think they've captured the imagination of a lot of people. The challenge now, and this is the subtlety I don't think always gets picked up, is first of all, people are happy with their gasoline-powered cars. It's not like they're, you know, walking around, you know, kicking empty cans and grousing about those vehicles. So it's the industry's job to dislodge them from that. But how do you do that? Well, if you really think about it, there's not a lot of variety out there compared to gasoline vehicles. There's, in the U.S. market, there's one vehicle, now that the Chevy Bolt is discontinued temporarily, that's less than $40,000. That's a Nissan Leaf. And a Nissan Leaf is a compact hatchback. Americans hate compact hatchbacks. They've never bought them in big numbers. And it gets about, I think, 210 miles of range might be the max on it. So, you know, that's not a great proposition for people, for most American consumers. But it's the only vehicle under $40,000 right now. Now that's not counting tax credits. I think you can get a Model 3 now, certain configurations with the tax credits under that, but they're still pretty expensive is the point. And there isn't nearly the variety that you have with gasoline powered vehicles where you can get
for sure anything,
a compact on up to a Hummer. You can get a Hummer actually, but
right.
There's just more variety, under $40,000. So, you know, I remember having, here's my analogy, conversations back in the early 2000s when Nissan and Toyota came out with full-size pickup trucks. I was writing for Business Week. My editor said, well, here it is. This is the end of Detroit because now the Japanese are taking their last stronghold. And they said, you know, they took the sedan and compact market away from the big three. Why wouldn't they also take pickups? And they said, you know, because of a variety of reasons, the quality of those family sedans and compacts made by the Detroit companies were truly terrible. And those consumers were really angry, and they were happy to leave. They actually left with two middle fingers in the air for the most part. But they were the people who bought pickup trucks. Those trucks were made pretty well, and those people loved them. So it's not going to be that easy for the Japanese to just steal those buyers. So what does that mean for the EV market? You have pretty happy buyers. I think when people drive EVs, they realize they're faster, smoother, quieter, and there's a lot about them that's really cool. But that's the industry's job, is to tell them why they should leave their regular cars right now. But they are happy with them. So for the same reason, you know, that then Dodge, now Ram, Chevy, and Ford didn't lose the pickup market, the gasoline-powered vehicle market's not going to just surrender itself so easily. Consumers are, you know, they like what they like. I think a lot of people will come around. It's just going to take longer than the industry thought.
And I'm kind of curious, since you are based in Detroit, what do you think is kind of the perspective and what you hear being kind of in the hub of Detroit versus maybe the more common narrative or maybe misperceptions people have about how electric vehicles are doing or that transition to them across the country?
Yeah, you're hearing more skepticism from inside the companies. And honestly, that was kind of always there. There were a lot of engineers and, you know, people working in the companies who would see these big plans from Ford and GM, big investments, and wonder, okay, is this really that smart? Is that market going to be there? And you're hearing more of it now because you've seen investment reined in, you've seen vehicle plans delayed, and you've seen sales, not just from these companies, but from others disappoint. You see Tesla discounting massively over the past year. So, you know, there was already some skepticism. Because what people don't necessarily love change.
Right.
Especially within their companies, right? And so you have, you know, Mary Barra or Jim Farley coming in saying, we're going to invest all this money. And in Ford's case, we're going to split the company in two. And, you know, the people in the new co are the cool kids, and the people in the old co are in this, you know, maybe a dinosaur of a company. And it turns out that, you know, the dinosaur is going to live longer, and new co doesn't, you know, is getting defunded in some ways. And so there's probably an I told you so too happening from people. It's, you know, I think what's happening in the EV market, the slowdown and also the slowdown in investment, which, by the way, drives a lot of the narrative we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
That has some skeptics saying I told you so.
You know, it's kind of funny you mentioned the Ford Blue and Ford Model E program, because that got so much attention when it was first kind of announced, and obviously when the market and kind of the EV momentum was much higher. And now it seems like we don't really hear too much about the delineation of those programs, unless it's maybe some sort of like quarterly report or kind of a smaller news story related to it. Do you think that, or I guess one, I'd be curious if you've been hearing any more of from kind of the inside of people that have seen that firsthand and how that actual execution of that business model has gone. And do you think it's more kind of taking a back seat just for the financials, or do you have any sense of how successful that program has been to kind of delineate into two companies at Ford?
I'm not sure. When they did it, there was a lot of pressure on GM to do the same thing. And GM had said basically that they had kind of already done it. It wasn't as aggressive. Because it's still reported to the same top executives. And actually, you mentioned John McElroy earlier. John and I had this debate at one point. Like, John thinks that any company, or at the time he did, I don't know what he thinks now because a lot of these things are going in reverse. He said any company that doesn't have its own separate EV company run by somebody from Silicon Valley, like, they're going to die. And I said, wait a second. You're talking about org charts here. You know, like, at the end of the day, Jim Farley runs Ford. And he makes the decisions for, you know, the blue oval side of the company and the EV side of the company. And that's that, right? You know, there are people working on just EVs at General Motors and Stellantis. At the end of the day, they report to the same CEO. And, you know, I can guarantee you when Ford decided to reduce investment by $12 billion, that wasn't decided by one person on the EV side of the company. That was Farley. It was the board of directors, just the same way it would be if they never split the company like that.
Right.
And when Mary Barra decided to delay the Orion Township pickup truck plant, that wasn't decided by the executive who runs the EV truck group that builds vehicles in Hamtramck. That was decided by her leadership team and the board. So, does it help them, getting people to develop technologies? Short answer is I don't know. I've always wondered about it because, there's a lot about both vehicles you still need, like, the basic guts of the car, the interiors, design, the chassis, all that kind of stuff, where you're having the same people engineer it, you still have to work with them. So, one of the things historically that got General Motors into trouble is, they used to have all the vehicle divisions had their own engineering groups. This goes back many decades. And for efficiency's sake, they put it all together. And a long retired GM executive told me that actually caused a lot of problems internally because, it used to be, you're a powertrain engineer and the transmission guy for Buick sat next to you or worked on your floor. And if there was an issue, you'd go over there and talk to him. And then once they reorganized everything, the expertise went hither and yon, and it really caused a lot of problems. I'm not saying that happened at Ford, but
right.
It's just, these things can work or they can not work. And I never saw that as a deciding factor. I mean, the bottom line is like these companies have to figure out how to make batteries and the software that makes all this stuff work and get the vehicles produced.
Well, and that is what's kind of interesting. I mean, in that example especially, I mean, that has been one of the things that the startups and even some of the Chinese companies, when asked about how they run their business or what has kind of led to the flatness of their organization and their speed, is actually kind of that old model where they will have the engineers and the designers and all of them close to where the cars are actually being manufactured. So it is kind of interesting to see that traditionally was and seems to still be a very cost-effective and time-efficient way to move vehicles forward. And I'm kind of curious with, has there been talk of trying to move back to that style of manufacturing more with some of these companies? I know there have been talk they were going to do that with, speaking of the Ford Model E and Blue programs, but I'm just kind of curious if that actually ever materialized or you've seen that even with GM. Or it's
more bringing more stuff in house, basically.
Bring more stuff in house, and just also bringing. I can think of a couple examples for Ford that they've kind of looked at, like the Ford GT and some of these where they take a very small dedicated group of people and just throw them at the problem and let them handle it, versus kind of some of the larger teams that we've traditionally seen from like the big three for the last couple of decades. Are you seeing any or hearing much about that across? Being in Detroit from like the traditional automakers about going more to these smaller kind of focused teams and almost more like a software style of product management.
They definitely did with like take the electric Hummer. They did that program in, I remember writing about this. It was like, typically these programs were like 4 years and they did it in like 23 or 27 months, something like that. Actually, it might've been 27. It was a little more than 2 years. And they had a very small team and they used to meet, all together in like one building in GM instead of like, different departments all over the company. And the guy who ran it was a guy named Josh Tavel, who's sort of co-head of product development at GM now. And I did a story on this. He borrowed from Amazon though, like the, I think it was the pizza rule where if you had a meeting, like one pizza should feed everybody in the meeting. Otherwise you've got a bunch of people who probably don't need to be there. And
right.
He had time limits on meetings. Like, this is how long we're going to spend meeting to like get decisions made. But it was a very small group, and that's how they got that vehicle done quickly. Now they've had problems with it. I don't know if it's related. I don't think it's related to the size of the management teams. I think it's just switching from making vehicles with engines and transmissions to EVs pretty hard. The whole industry is having a tough time with this.
Well, and that is something I do kind of want to talk to you about, because for the longest time, I felt like the traditional big three is like, oh, Tesla's doing their little thing. These startups are doing their little thing. When we want to make electric vehicles, we're going to be able to make electric vehicles. We made cars for decades. And a lot of people were saying, probably, but it is a different beast altogether. And now we are kind of seeing whether that's through, I think for Ford, they've actually been pretty effective, but it's been the cost challenges, trying to get those and supply chain. But then you look at GM, and it does seem to be that there have been some pretty big issues just across the spectrum of electric vehicle development and actually the manufacturing. What do you think? I mean, I think this could be its own podcast episode alone, but what do you think have been kind of the big takeaways from this experience? Or I don't know if hubris is the right word, but kind of the experience that maybe making electric vehicles wasn't as easy as they thought it would be, and how that might be affecting their decision-making.
Yeah, I think it's true across the board. So, you know, take GM. They've had this issue assembling battery packs, right? The Ultium pack. The Ultium pack, by the way, it was never like, there's no secret sauce in terms of battery chemistry or form factor or anything like that. What Ultium is it's an industrial strategy. It's, you know, you're taking your cells and you're putting X number of them into a box that's a module and X number of modules into a pack. And the number of modules that go into that pack, that's your Lego set. So you can make everything from a Chevy Bolt on up to a Hummer, right? Or a Cadillac Escalade. And it's basically the same basis of the vehicle, the same platform. And, you know, it's almost a manufacturing strategy. And that's the part where they've fallen down, right? Like the Ultium right. cells plant is doing fine. It's getting the battery packs made. And then they've shown some progress there, but then they've had all these software issues that have grounded the Chevy Blazer EV. They're not alone, right? Like Toyota had wheels falling off of the BZ4X. Right. And that's saying something. Like Volkswagen's, or Volkswagen, Toyota's one of the best, if not the best manufacturer in the industry, and they're having those issues. The Germans, Volkswagen, and I think Porsche, they both had issues with software, kind of like GM is. I think maybe different software problems, but software problems nonetheless. So,
I think it's kind of interesting to mention that now with kind of the ability of hindsight, it almost seems like the Germans knew, especially the VW group, they knew they had problems, so they just delayed all their vehicles. Whereas it seems like GM continued to just move forward with these, and now that they're out, or supposed to be out, they're really realizing how many of these software issues they have. But I'm sorry, yeah. What were you going to say there?
Well, I think in the case of GM and maybe a lot of these companies, and Ford too, right? Like they just recently stopped F-150 production because of quality issues.
Yeah.
They were so far behind Tesla, and they were in the Chinese for that matter. And they were in such a rush to catch up, and they had to be, that they probably, well, definitely bit off more than they can chew. And the evidence, they might deny that, but they've all had production quality software issues, you name it, and have had to stop production, ground vehicles for some period of time because of this. I think the software side of it was probably underestimated. They might not have had the right talent in place to do it. And same with battery, you know, the U.S. battery infrastructure, battery industry, it's like there really isn't much of one, right? We're relying on Korean and Chinese partners for the technology and the know-how. We gave it all away. And now we're rapidly trying to catch up. And there's a lot of software that goes into that too, the battery management.
Oh, for sure.
And, you know, do we have the expertise there? I don't think we do. I think we can get it. I mean, Silicon Valley is extremely adaptable, and there's a lot of people great at writing code. And I think that'll come. But, you know, and Tesla has it, right? So we as a nation, and our companies can get there, but it's really competitive to get the talent, and everyone's in a hurry. In a weird way, the fact that adoption and EV sales, the growth has slowed down a bit, it kind of gives some of the established old line car companies maybe a bit of a time out to figure out the industrial and the software and the technology side of this before the market really takes off. Because look, if the growth rates kept going at the way they were going, these guys would be in serious trouble because they wouldn't have the vehicles and they wouldn't have the production to meet it.
So, for sure.
In a way, they should be thankful that this has slowed down, even though it's making their lives difficult because, you know, if you're Mary Barr or Jim Farley and you've delayed factory plans or you've reined in investment for EVs, you know, now your decision is, do you have to do that more based on what the market does? Or if not, like, when do you, you know, hit the accelerator again?
These for are all sure.
For them. Now, they make more money than you and I do, so I have no sympathy. You have to make them. That's the job, right? But, you know, it's all going to be pretty tough on them. But they do have this maybe a bit of a market reprieve to figure it out.
Well, and that's interesting you bring that up, because that's something I've talked to with a few people about. And my take on it, and I'd be curious if anyone's kind of shared this, is what we're seeing is, yes, I think the demand for new cars in general is softened, but a lot of it is that focus on electric vehicles. And the domestic 3, 2.5, whatever you want to call them, are looking at moving kind of back to hybrids, plug-in hybrids. So there is a reprieve, but my question, what I'm kind of curious and would like to hear your thoughts on is, do you think it's a reprieve in the short term? Because by going back to what they're kind of comfortable with and know more about, to me, it just seems like it gives Tesla and some of the other startups, but especially the Chinese, the ability to kind of just keep leaning into what they're doing. So once that momentum or that interest catches up, or we kind of see some kind of growth return, they're going to be actually, I think, in an even better position, supply chain wise, technology wise, scale wise, to be ready to kind of just kind of turn up the factories versus being, if you're making just plug-in hybrids and now you're seeing more of a demand to go to full electrics or other things that you have to change a lot more. At least that's my opinion. And I'm kind of curious if you've heard any other kind of people talking about that locally.
It's not like it's not either or, like it's not like
with, for sure,
with the exception of Toyota, right? They're only making a couple EVs, but they do have more coming, and they're heavy on plug-in hybrids. I'll tell you, like, here's what I know, at least with the U.S. companies and to a degree with the European companies, they really don't want to do plug-in hybrids in big numbers. I think they want to do just enough in some key segments to meet the demand that's there and to meet fuel economy and greenhouse gas regulations that are going to get tougher. Because, you know, look, Toyota's great at making those. The Koreans are pretty good too. But they are expensive vehicles to make, because you still do have this electric system on board, and you still do have gasoline and exhaust and all that other stuff on board. So it's not a great and long-term business model. They're doing it because they feel they have to. And I think they're all still going to lean into the development of their EVs. Just a little less so, but the less isn't like emphasis on developing their supply chains and developing the software talent they need and the battery operations. The less is just like how much of it they're doing all at once. Now, so they're still going to be working on developing all of this stuff. They will be, I think they're going to be developing less volume because they're selling less volume, right? None of them do well in China, where the real EV volume is. So they're not going to get it there. And Ford does okay in Europe. GM is barely there. So they're not going to get it there. So they're going to have to rely on volumes in the US market to get it. GM in China is going to be interesting because they're struggling over there.
Yeah.
But you know, they do have this partnership with Wuling and Shanghai Automotive, SAIC. Those are their long-term partners, where they make small, really cheap EVs. You know, the Hongguang Mini has been a really big success for GM. But, you know, that's where GM can get some knowledge on how to make cheap EVs, in that market without having to, like, sell them under the Buick brand or develop their own operations. So that helps them there. But, you know, so can they replicate some of the learnings over there? Like, I think the biggest risk here is, and this is what the IRA, Biden's Inflation Reduction Act, is all about, is telling everybody, look, you can get all these great incentives to build and for your customers to buy EVs, but you have to do it here. And it's because, like, the U.S. industry sort of writ large needs to develop an EV industry. And Tesla has, but nobody else has. And that's to your point. I think that's where they can fall behind, specifically the Chinese, because, you know, the volume there is going to keep growing. And here it fits and starts.
Right. And scale, I think it's
one of the things in the auto industry, scale is so important.
Well, this this kind of also goes back to the conversation with John McElroy, where he was saying, I mean, the only reason Tesla got successful was it hit like 80,000 of the Model 3, and then it kind of takes off. If you don't have those numbers, then you're just burning money for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, I mean, think, look at Rivian and Lucid, yeah. Right? Like, right. You know, they're making, I mean, Rivian's making 50, 60,000 a year last year and forecast for this year. And they lose a lot of money and they burn a lot of cash. And Lucid does even fewer vehicles. But they, you know, those business models don't work. Those companies, I, you know, they're probably going to have to raise money and find investors who are willing to kind of tolerate losses for a long time until they can get real volume. Chinese are well past all that stuff. Tesla's well right. past all that stuff. Ford and GM still aren't close to that, and they're a lot closer than those startups. And you know, that's, so we kind of have three auto industries right now, right? We got Tesla, BYD, and these Chinese companies that have a lot of volume. Then you got Ford, GM, and the Germans, and the Japanese, who don't have a lot of volume and still have to go up that curve. Then you have these startups that, you know, are even further behind, and probably will be for a while because they don't have the distribution and the sales numbers to get there.
Well, and they have a much worse market and also much more competition than Tesla did during its growth phase. So and even same with the Chinese, at least in their market too. So it is kind of interesting. I'm a big fan of the Rivians. I think they're great looking vehicles. They're spendy.
They're cool, yeah.
But I even just saw a chart just a couple of days ago that kind of blew my mind that Rivian is actually in a worse financial position than Tesla was, kind of going through like the scale of Model 3 and all this stuff. So it was, I'm sure they'll be, I think of the startups, they're probably in the best position. Having the Amazon backing and that money behind it is something, if you need to get more funds, isn't bad. But yeah, it is a incredibly difficult time, I think, for everyone right now.
Tesla grew up in an era when raising cash was easy.
Right? Exactly.
Easy Wall Street money. There, you know, interest rates were super low. You could borrow money for next to nothing. And Elon Musk is just, you know, a lot of people hate him, but got to give the guy his due. He's, you know, great technologist. He's great at raising money, and he did it at a time when it was pretty easy.
Right.
Rivian and Lucid don't have that luxury right now. And the
Chinese kind of did too, just by being in China, having the government backing right. back then for what they were doing. So I completely agree with you in that standpoint. I don't think that's something that gets enough kind of perspective. It's like, even when you overlay the graphs of these startups and how they're doing compared to Tesla during its similar phase, it's just a much different sales market, much different supply chain, much different everything. But we're in agreement on pretty much all that, it sounds like. So let's kind of finally jump over to your book and really kind of go through what you've seen and discovered through GM and the whole process it's gone for. So I haven't been able to finish the book yet. I started reading and I really enjoyed it. So it's really interesting. But I would love to hear kind of, for those listening, what the book is about, what got you started on it, and then we can kind of go through some of the topics and the things you learned.
Sure. Look, it started with a cover story in Business Week, I'm trying to remember, I think it was 2019 or 20. This is basically, you know, looking at what Mary Barra had done with, must have been 2020 because it was after the 2019 strike. And she had downsized this global footprint, right? Like, she closed down Europe, closed down their operations in Russia, India, Southeast Asia, all these places GM lost money. And the idea was they were spending billions of dollars on new products there and losing money anyways. And they just weren't well positioned in the market. And it would take years to fix that. So her huge decision, and this is one of the biggest retrenchments in corporate history, not just the US, but worldwide. She closed down all that stuff and took all that money and plowed it into some of it into Cruise and getting into autonomy, but most of it into developing the Ultium battery and all of these vehicles. And by doing that, you know, there's an old saying in baseball, you can't steal second and keep your foot on first. So she cedes all of those markets to Toyota and Volkswagen and some others, but primarily Toyota and Volkswagen. She says, look, you guys can have all of those low margin sales in India, and you can have, the mess that is Russia, and you can have the, you know, overheated market that is Europe, and whatever's left in South Africa and Southeast Asia, fine. We're going to sell vehicles in Brazil, China, the US, and we're going to make a lot of money doing it. And then we're going to, all that money into EVs and become electric vehicle kings. Now, and she also restructured the U.S. business to make it more profitable. And so what that left us with is the GM of today, which is a cash machine. They generate a lot of money. But, you know, on her way there, she got in big fights with Donald Trump, right? There's a couple of chapters that there's one chapter just about the war with Trump, but he sort of, you know, Mary Barr became one of Trump's favorite targets. You know, she leaned up operations in the U.S., which meant a war with the UAW, which, you know, was really got hot in 2019, but reared its head again late last year with another strike. So, you know, you start bringing out change and closing certain operations, and, you know, presidents who promise people in Ohio that their jobs are coming back get very angry, and the union gets very angry. So she had to fight all of them in order to restructure this company. And then internally, there was pushback. You know, a lot of executives and engineers were questioning. There's some, you know, inside meetings on with debates on that about how much they should plow into electric vehicles and whether or not they should just do like one or two token EVs to say we're here. But her vision was to catch Tesla. Her vision was to make sure that, you know, Google via Waymo did not become the next generation of automaker. And she pushed really hard. Now, the book, I had to finish the book in, May of 21, June of 21. And I couldn't foresee all that's gone wrong today. However, I stand by everything in this book because the last chapter, the epilogue, basically looks at what was going on at the time I had to finish this book was she fired Dan Ammen as head of Cruise because things weren't working there. The Chevy Bolt was on fire. And they still didn't have, you know, any EVs out there to challenge Tesla. And, you know, in Wall Street parlance, it's GM has execution risk, which is, you know, that's very fancy banker language for these guys that might not be able to get this done. And so right. with all these problems they were having, I asked Mary in the last interview right before I finished the book, I said, do you ever feel like this company suffers from some kind of generational curse? Because, and I actually use those words in the book too, in that last chapter, because, you know, here GM is with the Volt, which, or the Bolt rather, which was actually a pretty successful product. You know, it had some loyal buyers, sold in pretty good numbers. The technology was pretty good. I mean, 280 miles of range on a small, or 270 on a small vehicle that sold for that price, pretty good. And, but then it's on fire. She had a bit of a sense of humor about it. She said, no, we're not cursed, and, you know, went on to explain that when you run a big company, there are always issues. But that did sort of, you know, presage the fact that, you know, this company does often have a lot of these problems. They just kind of, you know, they seem to open doors and have doorways collapse on their head at times. And
right.
And that's kind of what's happened with EVs. You know, look, she freed up money from lousy operations to put it into electric vehicles. And she had this platform that was going to give her something, you know, categories that represented 70, 75% of the U.S. market volume, right? All smart, and get there before Tesla did, except that they, you know, they haven't been able to execute. They haven't been able to get the cars out the door for the reasons we were talking about earlier. And it's not, I don't think it's anything particular to GM's ability or inability to do it compared to the other legacy car companies. I think they pushed so hard with so many vehicles all at once. And I do think they underestimated how tough it was going to be to make electric vehicles, because they had done the EV1 before. They did the Volt. They did the Bolt. This should be pretty easy. They've been making cars for 100 years. Why is it so hard? But it has been. And I think part of it is they were doing a lot all at once. And part of it is the game's changed, right? These are, you know, much more high tech EVs than they did in the past. And by the way, like the Bolt, you know, that was kind of heavy.
What you just did there, I think is even with part of the problems I had with their strategy is the Volt, people would always like, there's even marketing. I think that's what's been so surprising me is how you're talking about, like, GM had so many issues. Like, I feel like marketing, all these things that traditionally has been strengths for them, they even failed with. Like, it has been kind of across the board. But I'm sorry, what were we going to say there?
With the Bolt, you know, that vehicle was, and I think one of the reasons that they did all right with it in terms of quality was It was basically a Chevy Cruze, heavily retrofitted to fit a battery and become a Chevy Bolt, right? It wasn't an all-new platform, and that platform was the battery pack and the floor, the way it is with Ultium. And, you know, go back about 15-plus years, Nissan opened the plant in Mississippi, and they had an all-new minivan platform. They had an all-new they had the pickup truck, which was new to them, and they had an all-new platform for the Altima, even though they'd been making minivans and Altimas before, all-new platform. They had tremendous quality and production problems there. And these are the kinds of vehicles Nissan have been making forever. There's nothing special about them. They were just new platforms. But they bit off a lot all at once and had a real, you know, and they choked on it. And I think in GM's case, yeah, they did the Volt and the Bolt, and they did the EV1 years ago. But this, even this, this new stuff is so different. And it was more than, clearly more than they could do, because the past year has been a big problem. You bring up marketing. I'm not sure GM is a great marketing company. Like the GMC brand has one of the best brand names in the business. Actually, I guess Chevy does, you know, is very consistent too. They've had Cadillac's been a problem for a long time.
I agree with you there too. I think what I meant was specifically around marketing their electric vehicles, like doing the Volt, and just kind of some of this name branding, and then having these huge Super Bowl ads and stuff. Obviously, the big stuff of kind of like having Biden coming in, say they're leading the way. And I think that totally all adds to what you were talking about having all this pressure on them to get out the door, and it just can almost push them to go faster. And unfortunately, probably at their own detriment. But
yeah, look, I think they saw it as an existential fight.
Right.
And, you think about it, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, everybody, analysts, investors, the think tanks, the car companies, they all thought that there was going to be a somewhat linear, I mean, I don't think anyone thought EV growth was going to be totally linear, but I don't think they saw it leveling off the way it is now. And they really, people thought autonomy.
Now, because has it been about a year since your book came out?
A little more, about a year, year and three, what, 4 months.
Gotcha. What would be the chapter that you would have written to make it like relevant to today? Or like, what are the things that maybe have surprised you or kind of standout moments that have led since that book came out? I mean, it sounds like a lot. I mean, everything I've read still seems relevant. And it almost seems like the stuff I've read so far has just kind of come to fruition. But I'm curious if there's anything else you would add to it.
You know, yeah, definitely. So look, if I could do another chapter on this thing, I would make the epilogue just chapter, I think it's 12.
Yeah.
And then I would have a new epilogue that gets into all these struggles that the company has had just making battery packs and writing the software and everything with Cruise. And that, by the way, that other companies have had too. I think it's worse than GM, because GM pushed harder. They sold this harder, and they've had all the problems. So some companies have had just software, some have had production issues, and GM's got them all. So, so there'd be a chapter, you know, just looking at all these problems that have been way worse than they thought. And they, you know, there've been some reputational damage at GM about this, for sure. And, you know, from an investment standpoint, you know, look what they've done, they bought back shares and they raised their dividend. That's telling investors, we're not a hot growth company with our EV plans right now. We're a value company that returns cash to shareholders. So they've sort of thrown in the towel on being rapid growth until they get their hands on this thing. Doesn't mean they won't be at some point, but that's where they are. I would have written that, you know, a chapter on that. And if I could change anything about it, the only thing I would probably really change is there was some, not that the title's still pretty cool, Charging Ahead, because Mary Barra really did charge ahead. The cover language was maybe a little more optimistic and than I'd like it to be at this point, because they've had such a tough time with the challenge. I wanted the cover language to be more, she's betting, you know, making a big bet on this thing. It's a fight that I lost.
That's interesting.
When you think about it, you decide in your core business, you're going to give up all these overseas markets and let Toyota, Volkswagen, and other domestic players in those countries have that sales volume and whatever business you can do there. And by the way, you know, Peugeot, which is now Stellantis, has done pretty well with Opel since GM sold it to them. It can be done. So, you know, it was a big gamble, and so far it hasn't paid off. I still, McElroy and I were talking about this on his show. We still think her vision is the right one, but the last thing she has to fix is, does this company have the chops to see it through? That's the big question. And I still don't have an answer to that.
Well, and one of the things you guys kind of alluded to or kind of threw out there that I think I watched this episode, the one that was maybe a month ago or so. And I'm kind of curious about how long she has to make those changes before the pressure is like, we might need someone else in charge. Because one of the interesting things I kind of indirectly got a lot of attention towards her in a negative way was the whole Elon Musk pay package thing. That I was like, oh, this got struck down. He made $60 billion. But like, well, he only made that money because of the agreements that, and I think to some extent there's pros and cons to it and maybe unrealistic for someone who isn't a founder, but the idea that, yeah, he got paid out a bunch, but it made a bunch of money for the shareholders. And there's also other variables involved in that. But then it kind of brought in the, even in the news cycle, some attention, like they were looking at Mary Barra. It's like, well, the stock price is essentially, it went up, maybe doubled at one point, but now it's back to where it was after 10 years. They paid her $200 million. And when you include inflation, it's less than what it was worth when she started. And obviously that is an uphill battle for anyone to fight. I think being the CEO of GM might be less, a more difficult and less like job than being president even right now. But I'm kind of curious on what your thoughts are on like that forward looking and how much time she really has to make a change to kind of guarantee she stays in her role much longer.
Yeah, well, she's 62 now, right? So she could retire in 3 years.
That's a good point. Yeah.
And, you know, I think, you know, the only way the board would throw her out, I mean, look, it's, I think the optics of the, you know, the first and only female CEO of an auto company, not saying they'd keep her if she wasn't doing the job because of that, but, you know, it'd be tough for them to make that call if there wasn't like a serious, like something seriously wrong with the company. Like they can't just say, yeah, we need a change in direction. You're not quite it. I mean, look, they can do whatever they want, but I don't think that's why they do it.
And that's fair. Yeah. Well, I'm just going to say that's fair. And I mean, she's been CEO for a decade now, which is a lot longer than some other former GM CEOs.
And look, so, you know, if the board wants to make a case that they keep her in place, and the company's profits and cash flow are really, really strong. Their core business does great. And
that's a good point.
They, you know, and so her vision, which started with making this a better run, more profitable car company, look, their vehicle quality and productivity, all the stuff that had to be fixed when she got in has been fixed. So there are a lot of things on that side of the ledger that the board would point to say, you know, this is why we don't throw her out. I'm not, by the way, I'm not saying that, you know, because she's a woman that they wouldn't fire her if she needed to be fired. What I'm saying is that more of a magnifying glass on any decision they made like that.
For sure.
So they would have to take it really seriously. The only thing I could see is, let's just say, you know, this issue with getting the vehicles out, if this persists, or if there's like some terrible situation where there's a bunch of fires and some nasty recall like we had with Bolt or with the ignition switch over a decade ago,
yeah,
you know, something like that, and you know, she had mishandled it or was responsible for it, or if they just decided they needed somebody else who could fix that sort of thing, I think something like either just failure to get the EVs out the door and see this mission out, or you know, some other kind of cataclysmic sort of thing, because she's got 3 years, and look, I think she would want to stick around to fix these problems and at least see this part of her vision out. That's what I think.
No, I think those are really good points, and yeah, I think you're totally right. Like if it was an ignition level issue, like essentially what kind of is the reason she got on the job previously, that level of optics, that negative, where they kind of have to make some big changes. I could see that, but I think you're right. And had what we have discussed around like the electric vehicle growth trajectory stay the same, I think there'd be a lot more pressure on her around that. But since we have kind of seen that pulled back a bit, I think the points you're talking to exactly kind of put her in a pretty safe space for that. I just wanted to ask and get your thoughts on it.
It's a favorite part of her game now, because she's 3 years from turning 65. Like, how long does she stay? And, you know, because they've had these problems, do they throw her out? I mean, there's no indication they would. And, you know, look, you know, what they've approved this $10 billion share buyback, and, you know, the financial moves that she's made, and, you know, some of the, you know, promoting some young stars at the company at the end of last year. So, you know, they have to be behind her if they're approving some of these big moves. So she's, you know, she's got time. Now, look, if the board comes out and issued a statement soon saying they fully back her, that probably means she's going to get fired. Now, I mean, it's kind of sarcastic, but it's
that's kind of funny. Yeah.
Puts out a statement saying that we love the CEO. They're doing a great job. That they're usually gone within a month, right?
Yeah.
I could see her, you know, finishing the job at 65 pretty easily. I mean, we're already, you know, less than 3 years from there.
Right. And I think one we've talked about very briefly, but obviously we've been focused more on the EV challenges they've been having. But as you mentioned earlier, Cruise and the autonomous vehicle program there, when you were writing the book and just going through that, obviously, I don't know enough about the team. I don't know enough about what their program is doing or what the state of it is. As far as autonomous ride hailing services, it was good. It seems like Waymo, even before they kind of shut down Cruise, was, I think, had kind of the better long-term strategy, just personally looking from the outside. And now that there's so much kind of negativity, autonomous vehicle space especially has really cooled off in the last 18 months. Just from what we've seen externally about, like, the head goes, then they remove all these other people. And now it's like every couple of months, there's a new announcement. Well, they're laying off another 24%. What do you think the future for that program is? Like, is it they're just kind of slowly trying to just say, you know what, we gave it a good shot and we want to get rid of it and try not to make as big of a hubbub about it? I mean, with even Apple just the other day announcing that they're stopping their program. Like, what in your research and kind of like connections there, do you think is the current sentiment and maybe future for that program at GM?
Yeah, look, we just, you know, we broke a story last week that they were resuming testing with safety drivers. Probably Houston or Dallas, they're looking at those two markets. Texas is a pretty easy place to run AVs. The regulatory environment's, you know, pretty lax, particularly compared to California. So, you know, they're gonna put their foot back in the pond here and see what they can do with it. You know, if they were going to shut it down, I think they already would have, because they were spending a lot of money on this and their investors did not like that. You know, one of the things that pushed their share price up recently was the earnings were good. You know, they had done all these share buybacks and everything, and they reduced spending in Cruise.
Yeah. Yeah.
You look at the valuation of GM. In fact, Paul Jacobson, the CFO, has been saying this for about a year. He said, look, if you buy GM now, you're getting GM at a cheap price historically, and you're getting Cruise for free. Which what that says is investors place no value on Cruise. And really, if you look at the other autonomous vehicle stocks like Aurora, and these are all trading at next to nothing.
Right.
And, you know, none of the privately held AV trucking companies, some of which are doing some pretty interesting things, they're not going public right now because the market doesn't like any of this stuff.
Yeah.
So, point is, if GM wanted to shut it down, they could shut it down right now, and I think their investors would like it. The reason I don't think they will is, one, they do believe in the technology, and in a way, you know, what GM shutting the whole thing down and a lot of the bad PR and problems they've got, governance problems. It's almost because they've had one incident that was horrific, also really rare. Now that's sort of their line. That's not what I'm trying to do. It's just like the technology was actually working fairly well. I don't think it was working as well as Waymo's, but it was working fairly well in terms of safety and being able to do its job. So they see something worth saving. And then look, the other part is when you spend $10 billion in buying back your shares, what you're saying is we don't have a good place to put that money that will grow the business. So if they didn't spend whatever I think the remaining is going to be between one and a half and $2 billion a year on Cruise instead of two plus, they would just buy back more shares or raise the dividend, right? Yeah. I don't think that's going to do much for investors. I mean, you're already returning $10 billion, returning $11 billion is not going to get them that much more in love with your stock. So, you know, they've done what they need to do to return money to their owners. And you know, other than continuing the EV push, Cruise is really the one other place where they see some potential growth in revenue, along with software services. But that's you know, a different issue and was never as big a part as Cruise was supposed to be in this big plan they have to grow. So, you know, and look, there aren't that many. There are, what, two robotech, well, May Mobility. There are three robotaxi companies in the U.S. left standing. If you got the money, why not keep trying to develop it? They're just going to have to do it slowly. I also think, you know, long term, if robotaxi doesn't work out as a business, and that's different than the technology working. The technology could work, but you still have to have a business that makes money.
That justifies, means, yeah.
You know, managing the fleet has to be cheaper than what you can get people to pay you. And I'm suspicious of that, by the way, because I don't think consumers care whether it's, you know, Vinnie Romano from Queens in a yellow cab or Uber and Lyft drivers or a robot driving that car. They don't care as long as it's safe, on time, gets them where they want to go. And I'm an Italian American, so I can say Vinnie Romano, by the way. And so I, you know.
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite things, I used to go to New York all the time for work trips. And so, like, if it was between a yellow cab or I always had infinitely more fun taking the cabs in New York.
Yeah, absolutely.
Doing an Uber.
But for the most part, consumers don't really care.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, what's the draw for the robotaxi unless it really is cheaper? And then if it's cheaper, you have the cost of running the business has to be cheap. So it's got to be more than that. And what could end up being, if robotaxi just isn't a great business, is, you know, GM is theirs, being the first car company to sell, you know, personally owned self-driving vehicles. And, you know, consumers do like stuff like Autopilot, like GM Super Cruise, like Ford's Blue Cruise. You know, they like those systems and they pay extra money as a subscription for them in most cases or for the hardware. So there's a business there. And if you have something that's closer to fully autonomous, I think people will pay for that. And there are other things, you know, there are shuttles at certain places, at, you know, airports, entertainment venues, the Bourbon Trail, you name it. There are places right. where that stuff makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And there is a potential business for fleet-owned or personally-owned self-driving vehicles. And so I think they're developing it for that reason, too. So if they don't have a robotaxi in every city, so what? They'll be selling these vehicles somewhere, somehow. You know, Dan Ammann, who used to run Cruise for GM, said something to me once, and I think he's still probably right. Which is, and this is back when we had like, you know, more than a dozen autonomous vehicle companies getting funding. He said, look, we don't need 12, 14, whatever AV stacks. It'll end up being like operating systems where you've got Android and iOS, right? You need like two or three. Yeah. That's not counting trucking. But so maybe you need a couple for trucking and a couple for personally owned vehicles.
But even in the software space, you have commercial, you have, I mean, that makes sense.
Yeah. So it could go that direction.
Interesting. I do realize we're kind of coming up on an hour here, but there are two areas I did want to talk to you. Sure. We focus so much about GM as the company internally. There's been two big headwinds, especially in the sales of electric vehicles and also just the manufacturing that are kind of external, but two things GM has to work with, and that is the UAW and dealerships. With the most recent kind of strikes and stuff, the union challenges, where do you see that there is a viable way, should electric vehicles kind of get that momentum again, and if we do see Chinese and other cheaper vehicles come in, do you think that there is a strong, or do you think the current path can be done with the UAW, or do you think that's going to cause a lot more headwinds and fighting between GM and the UAW to get to those cost competitiveness and the traditionally less manufacturing needs of EVs.
I mean, so coming out of the strike we just had, one of the big things that I think kind of set the union's nerves at ease a bit is, you know, they basically brought the union into the battery plants. And that was their one big fear, is that all these engine and transmission jobs and fuel systems, emission systems, all that stuff, they go away, and then they buy batteries and electric motors from Asia or something like that.
Right.
So between unionizing the battery plants and the Inflation Reduction Act, which is, you know, mandating that in order for all this money to come in from the government, you have to build it here, you know, that cut the union in on that part of the deal. Now, the other part, you know, will EVs be easier to make? There are a lot fewer parts, and they're doing things with how Tesla does vehicle bodies. And I think over time, that could reduce the amount of labor needed. That's kind of always happened through efficiencies and automation and everything else. Does that accelerate that? I'm not so sure, but I mean, if I had to guess, I'd say, yeah, it probably will. So, you know, that could be the fight for down the road. The way that car companies have always handled is they retire people out and don't replace as many of them. And although with this one, you know, this union contract was a pretty good one for the union. It was pretty rich. And yeah. Sean Fain, the UAW president, kind of, you know, he had some very tough rhetoric for these companies, and things got pretty tense. So I think what you probably see over time is that this, you know, companies remember these things. And if they have to downsize, it wouldn't be their Mexican operations, put it that way. But look, if Chinese vehicles get here in big numbers and they're a lot cheaper, you know, then Katie bar the door for everybody, because that's going to be a problem. Now, look, Mary Barra said on the earnings call when she was asked about the Chinese companies coming here, said there are certain things about the Chinese market that make building and developing vehicles inherently cheaper, something to that effect. And it's not just labor. So, you know, would the Chinese vehicles be at as big a discount here as they are there? I'm not sure. I think they will be cheaper. I think we can rest assured on that, because they've got more scale and more expertise with EVs. But yeah, if they can get into the U.S. market for a lot less money, you know, the union's going to have a problem, and so are the companies.
Yeah, that's what's kind of been interesting with the recent announcement of BYD and others kind of moving to Mexico. So kind of gets around a couple of the challenges of selling into the U.S. BYD even said they're like, oh, no, we don't have any interest in doing that just yet. We're just selling to the Mexican market. But it is
selling in South America, too. You know?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I think this thing I saw, she was in Mexico City town. But you're right. It is kind of south of the border and then some. But it's hard to believe that, okay, maybe that's the case for the next few quarters. But once those factories are up and running, that they're not going to start seriously looking more at moving into the U.S. and trying to really compete there.
You saw what Biden said the other day, where, you know, EVs pose a national security threat. So, you know, that's a way to levy more tariffs. What the Biden administration strategy looks like, it's going to be, is use protectionist measures to safeguard the U.S. industry until they can get caught up and compete, because right now it doesn't look like they can compete. Otherwise, you would need protectionist measures.
Yeah, and given that we're going into an election year, it's kind of all up in the air as to what that's going to be for the future. Right. But real briefly, I guess the last thing would be just to talk about the dealerships real quickly and your thoughts on, obviously, when GM was, Ford obviously saw this too, when they were kind of pushing some of the programs for their electrification and being certain dealerships that would push electric vehicles over others. You saw a bunch of dealerships drop out, especially with Cadillac. And so I'm kind of curious as to what you think that means for GM long-term. I mean, a big part of the actual, it's one thing to, they're having trouble making the EVs. Once you start making them, then you have to actually be effectively moving them.
Right.
And that falls to something out of their, a whole lot of it out of their control with the dealerships. And where do you think the future of that is, and possibly what GM can do to help ensure their EVs that they start making are successful and start moving, other than just saying they have a great starting price?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's something they need to really get on top of. because, you know, we've seen skepticism from the dealers, right? You know, they were already pushing the federal government
right
on this thing. You know, look, dealers don't like change because that means they have to invest more money and change how they do work on the showroom floor. They've been that way. However, if something sells and they can make money on it, they'll be all over. So, you know, we get down to, you know, the big challenge for the legacy car companies is once they presumably get to the point where they're building a lot of EVs, they have to market them. They really have to, which is a challenge. They have to get people who shop EVs to look at their brands, right? Right now it's mostly Tesla, and it can be done. Ford did a very good job getting awareness for the Lightning. So it certainly can be done, but you know, they're having issues keeping demand up for that as well. I think it's a function of price, but
for sure.
And look, they're not going to like this because they've never had to do marketing for BP and Exxon and the filling stations, but they're going to have to do something to get awareness for charging. So, and it can't just be, look, we're working with 12 different apps you can use to charge. They're going to have to convince people that charging is not going to be a problem for them. So, you know, this is a different marketing challenge than they've had, but they have to do it. And because I don't think they're not going to be able to solve any resistance from dealers on selling EVs just by talking to the dealers. I mean, there are dealers who are into it, especially those, you know, who are in markets where people like EVs. And luxury dealers are into it because they know luxury buyers like EVs. But they, you know, they're really, as we see them try to penetrate the mass market, they're just going to have vehicles that sell because, you know, if you asked a dealer 25 years ago, do you want to invest a bunch of money in Hyundai, you know, after wasn't the Excel that had all those quality problems in the 90s?
I think 25 years ago.
Yeah. How can I interest you in this Hyundai franchise? They'd say, no, you have one crappy compact with bad quality problems. Forget about it. But now, you know, Hyundai sales are pretty strong. They're a big piece of the market, and a lot of dealers are investing in those franchises. Those guys, you know, the money talks, and those guys follow it. So, you know, they've just got it. They got to make products people want. They have to market them. They have to market the whole charging experience, get people used to it, and that'll solve any issue with the dealers. Those guys like selling cars, and that's all there is to it.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned Hyundai and Kia because, yeah, both of them have had pretty successful electric vehicles just from a product standpoint, and so it makes it a lot easier to then sell them. One thing I've heard, and I'd be kind of curious on maybe your thoughts of this, is like a lot of very electric vehicle advocates are pushing for the idea, well, the OEM should just spiff electric vehicles more instead of the regular combustion engine cars at dealerships. And my immediate thing is like, well, okay, so they have to now even pay more. What thin margins and challenges they had with EVs just becomes even that much more exponential. I think it is, it totally goes to what you're saying about like, yeah, a salesperson is going to be incentivized if they have to do more work, but there's a bigger payoff. Yeah, that probably would work. But do you think that that is a realistic possibility with just the other challenges, the financial challenges, I guess, that some of these companies are having with just getting the EVs off to the dealerships?
You know, they may have to invest some money here and, you know, maybe... you know, do they add incentive? I mean, look, there's a lot of government money incentivizing True. These things already. But to get dealers on board, do they have to raise the markup that the dealers get to keep? I mean, it's a possibility. The dealers don't like when they do stuff like that. The dealers want to, you know, manage that side of it. But I mean, that's one thing they could do. And look, the car companies have been cutting the markup that the dealers get to keep for a long time. And so, you know, if you push that in the other direction for EVs, that could move the needle. I think they've got programs to help them invest the money they need for the repairs and service base and that sort of thing. But it is an investment for these guys. So
for sure,
you know, to get them all on side, they're going to have to do it. I mean, look, you've seen GM with its Cadillac and Buick dealers. You know, you've seen them thin the herd because they just basically bought them out. If they didn't want to sell EVs.
Yeah.
And in some ways it's better because their dealer network was too big in some markets anyway. So the surviving dealers just sell more cars and they're happy, you know, because they're getting more throughput in their store, more profit for them. So you know, I think they may have to create these incentives, but, you know, look, the biggest thing they can do is just make a cool EV that people want.
Right.
And I mean, which sounds simple, but I mean, if you do that and the dealers are, you know, the dealers, will, they'll, if something, if customers want it, they'll move it. And when I talk to dealers, their biggest complaint is that a lot of them will tell me the same thing. Ah, you know, people aren't coming in here asking us for EVs.
And I mean, the good or bad is if it's a hot car, they can mark it up. And yeah, exactly. So I think that is really, I completely agree with you. I think the challenge, and that's obviously why Tesla's had so much success along with some of the other startups, is good product. You have a product that looks good, that works well, easy to use. And some of it obviously is generational connection, but yeah, I think that is the biggest challenge that some of these legacy automakers have. I agree with you. The Lightning's a good product, but it's way too, for what it is, it's priced way too high.
The price is still way too big for most people on a lot of these EVs.
And I guess one last thing, I'm sorry, then we'll let you go. With the announcement yesterday of the Ford now being able to use the Tesla charging network, do you think, I think that does kind of help actually with some of the education and just kind of offlaying at the now dealerships, instead of having to go really deep into it, it's like, hey, you can use the Tesla ones, they work. Do you think that that is a wise long-term strategy for these companies, that essentially every time that someone goes on a road trip or needs to charge somewhere, they're using a literally a competitor's product and then sees the...
I've asked them this question myself and they all tell me that, you know, it's not a problem, but you know, when you're arch rival and selling EVs, you know, it's their brand name on the charger that works. That is a marketing advantage for Tesla. And, you know, one underrated thing about Tesla is they're a great marketing company. And Elon Musk is a great marketer himself. And look, in some ways he can be his own worst enemy, but the guys, you know, he and his company always have attention. Right.
Right.
And this is,
They are kind of the example of, even bad news is good news.
Yeah, in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
If people like the other EVs, you know, they'll buy them and just use Tesla's charger, knowing that, you know, that's the place to go charge. And look, Tesla will make some money off of this because they'll build more chargers, and, you know,
for sure,
they'll make some money off of it. It's not like the charging business isn't a huge money maker for them, but it will make them some money. I think as I look at the market, I mean, other than Cybertruck, you know, Tesla's vehicles, you know, you're looking at two big, two sedans, two crossovers with pretty much the same styling. So, you know, as we get more vehicles from other companies from brands that people are already loyal to, I think they can overcome the fact that people are going to go to Tesla for charging. And the other thing is, like, people go to so many different chargers wherever they need it, wherever it's convenient, that, I think they'll be okay with it, but
I think there's truth to that, and definitely in the long term. But as someone who's done a lot of EV road trips, I've been consistently disappointed by
the others.
And every time it's like every time I try to give them the benefit of the doubt, I'm like, well, actually, this is a higher power charge one. Technically, it'll save me 10 minutes. It always costed me 20 minutes, and I usually just end up driving to the Tesla one down the road anyway.
Yeah.
But I guess one comment on that is I do think it was really, it's interesting that Jim Farley and the Ford team did kind of position, I thought they were vocal about this. I haven't really heard a similar thing from GM, but they looked at it as actually it's a great opportunity to get in with Tesla and like see Tesla drivers, then see our products on a regular basis, and almost kind of looked at it as an acquisition, or whether that is them trying to market and position why they have to do this, I don't know, but at least the strategy of it did sound kind of good. And then the other thing that I'm imagining GM will do is the fact that they included the plug and charge protocol. So when you plug in a Ford EV, it charges pretty much exactly this. You don't have to use the app. You don't have to kind of do all the other stuff that these other charge. I mean, once again, which makes the charging network for Tesla that much better. But with that, David, I've taken plenty of your time today. I really do want to say thank you for all this. Has been really fascinating. And I'm sure our listeners would have really enjoyed your perspective and just kind of learning more about the GM backstory and challenges they faced with electric vehicles and where they're going. So I'll let you get going. And thank you so much for joining us today.
A
As we wrap up today's episode with David Welch, we hope you found this episode of Grid Connections both insightful and inspiring. David's expertise and his book Charging Ahead offer a fascinating glimpse into the challenges and opportunities facing General Motors as it tries to reinvent itself in the current automotive industry. Before you go, we do have a few parting requests, though. If this episode sparked your interest or curiosity, please share it with someone else who would find it just as informative. Your support by sharing helps us reach more listeners passionate about the topics we discuss. Our podcast downloads have actually been growing on average almost 30% month over month for the past 6 months. The majority of this growth has come naturally from our listeners sharing our podcast with like-minded and curious individuals. By keeping this momentum going, it means we can continue to get the great guests we all enjoy on to discuss the topics we're all passionate about. Plus, stay ahead of this curve by signing up for our weekly newsletter, which you can find a link to in the show notes. It's your direct line to the latest industry news, exclusive insights, and behind-the-scenes content from Grid Connections. Remember, we're always on the lookout for fresh topics and remarkable guests to bring onto the show. So if there's someone you're eager to hear from or a subject you can't wait to dive into, let us know. Your suggestions are invaluable to making this show become what we all want it to be. For those interested in learning more about GM's evolution and the broader shift towards electric and autonomous vehicles, remember to check out the show notes for the link to get a copy of David's book, Charging Ahead. We're grateful for your enthusiasm for the subjects we cover on this podcast. Thank you for tuning in. And until next week, this is the Grid Connections Podcast, signing off.